The Master of the Messenger. In such wise, and so simply, had Eliezer painted Abraham to Joseph with his words. But unconsciously his tongue forked in speaking, and talked of him quite otherwise as well. Always it was Abram, the man from Uru, or more correctly from Haran, of whom the forked tongue spoke, calling him the great-grandfather of Joseph. Both of them, young and old, were quite aware that, unless by moonlight, Abram was not the man, that unquiet subject of Amraphel of Shinar. Likewise, that no man's great-grandfather lived 20 generations before him. Yet this was a trifling inexactitude compared with others at which they had to wink. For that Abraham, of whom the tongue now spoke, changefully and inconsistently, was not he either who had lived then and shaken the dust of Shinar from his feet, but rather a different figure perceptible far behind the other, visible through him, as it were, so that the lad's gaze faltered and grew dim in this perspective, just as it had in the one called Eliezer. An ever brighter vista, of course, for it is light that shines through. Then came into view all the stories which belonged to that half of the sphere in which master and servant, not with 318 men, but alone, save for the help of supernatural powers, drove the foe beyond Damascus, and in which the ground had sprung towards Eliezer the messenger. The story of Abraham's birth, foretold by prophecy, of the massacre of innocents on his account, of his childhood in a cave, and how the angel fed him while his mother sought him round about. All that bore the mark of truth. Somewhere and somehow it was true. Mothers always wander and search. They have many names, but they wander about the fields and seek the poor child that has been led away into the underworld, murdered or mutilated. This time she was called Emathla, also probably Emtali, names in which Eliezer probably indulged his fantasy, for they were better suited to the angel than to the mother. The latter, indeed, in an effort at verisimilitude on the part of the forked tongue, may also have had the form of a goat. Joseph found it all very dreamlike. His eyes changed their expression as he listened, and heard that the mother of the Chaldeans was called Emtali, for the name quite plainly signifies Mother of my Elevated One, or in other words, Mother of God. Should the good Eliezer have been reproved for talking like that? No. Stories come down as a god becomes man. They civilize themselves, as it were, and become earthly, without thereby ceasing to take place on high and to be narratable in their celestial form. For instance, the old man sometimes referred to the sons of that Keturah whom Abram in his old age took for a concubine, Medan, Midian, and Jokshan, that is, Zimran, Ishbak, and whatever their names were. These sons had glittered like lightning, and Abram had built for them and their mother a brazen city, so high that the sun never shone inside it, and it was lighted by precious stones. His listener would have had to be much duller than he was not to see that this brazen city signified the underworld, as whose queen, in this version, Keturah accordingly appeared. An unassailable conception. Keturah was indeed simply a Canaanitish woman whom Abram in his old age honored by his couch. But likewise, she was the mother of a whole series of Arabian progenitors and lords of the desert, as Hagar the Egyptian had been mother of Ishmael. And when Eliezer said of the sons that they glittered like lightning, that meant nothing else than seeing them with both eyes instead of with one, in token of the simultaneous and the unity of the doubled, that is, as homeless Bedouin chiefs, and as sons and princes of the underworld, like Ishmael, the wrongful son. Then there were other moments in which the old man spoke in strange accents of Sarah, forefather's wife. He called her Daughter of the Unmanned, and Heaven's Queen, adding that she had given birth to a spear, and that it was quite proper that she had originally been called Sarai, namely heroine, and only been toned down by God to Sarah, that is to say, lady. A like thing had happened to Sarah's brother husband, for he was reduced from Abram, which means the exalted father and father of the exalted, to Abraham, which is to say, the father of many, of a swarming posterity, spiritual and physical. But had he therefore ceased to be Abram? By no means. It was only that the sphere rolled, and the subtle tongue, forking between Abram and Abraham, spoke of him now so, and then again so. Nimrod, the father of the land, had sought to devour him, but he had been snatched away, fed in a cave by a goat angel, and when he was grown up had played so shrewd a game with the greedy king and his idolatrous majesty that one might even say that the latter came to feel the sickle. He had suffered much before achieving his position. He had been held captive. It was heartening to hear how he had employed his imprisonment to make proselytes and to convert the keepers of the dungeon to the Most High God. He was sentenced to be sacrificed to Typhon, in other words, to be burned, had been put in the lime kiln, or, Eliezer's versions varied, had mounted the stake. This last sounded genuine to Joseph, for he knew that even in his time, in many cities, a feast of the stake was celebrated. And are there ever feasts without an idea at bottom? Feasts without a root? Unreal feasts? Do people at New Year's, on the day of creation, perform in pious mummery things which they have sucked out of themselves, or out of an angel's fingers, and which never really happened? Man does not think himself out. He is, of course, exceeding clever, since he ate of the tree, and is not far from being a god. But with all his cleverness, how should he be able to find something which is not there? Yes, there must have been some truth in the story of the stake. According to Eliezer, Abraham had founded the city of Damascus, and had been its first king. A specious utterance. But towns are not in the habit of being founded by men, nor do the beings which one calls their first kings wear human countenances. Hebron itself, called Kirjath Arba, outside which they were sitting, had not been built by human hands, but by the giant Arba, or Arbael. At least so ran the legend. Eliezer, on the other hand, stuck to it that Abram had founded Hebron as well. That may have been no contradiction to the popular idea, nor should have been so. Forefather must himself have been of a giant's greatness. That was already clear from the fact that, according to Eliezer, he had taken steps a mile long. What wonder, then, that to Joseph, in dreamy moods, the figure of his forefather, the founder of cities, merged to the distant view in that of Bel of Babel, who built the tower and the city, and who became a god after he too had once been a man and been buried in the Baal tomb. With Abraham it seemed to be the other way round. But again, what does that mean in such a connection? Who will say what Abram had been at first, and where the stories are originally at home, whether above or below? They are the present of the revolving sphere, the unity of the dual, the image that resolves the riddle of time.